got picked on at school for things he couldn't change. He tried his best to play it cool, but in the seventh grade, you either fit right in or you don't fit. That's just the cold hard truth. I wish that I'd have been the friend that Billy never knew. I think it's time to come together, you and I can make a change. Maybe we can make a difference, make the world a better place. Look around and love somebody, we've been hateful long enough. Let the good Lord reunite us to this country that we love, undivided.
Yep.
Welcome back. Top of the second hour of today's Road Warrior Radio broadcast this Thursday, July 20th, 2023. And we are unpacking Chapter 10 of Hayek's Road to Serfdom, Why the Worst Get on Top. And we're about to really dive into it. Maybe we are in a time where we are so desensitized and we are so saturated that this just doesn't have the impact maybe it once had or it should have today. But we're going to do it nonetheless. I've mentioned this many times. We're headed into another election season, obviously. And I think this is provocative food for thought. I mentioned this. This chapter in particular before the 2016 election, especially, and it's interesting. Some people are noticing there is a coalescence, there's a coalescing of a force, an influence. You know, you might say it comes in different ways in different places. The ecumenical movement, for example, that seems to be bridging religious divides now and reaching out even beyond what would seem to be religious divides into social and political divides. The centrist bent in politics, the Marcusean repressive tolerance that seeks to bridge social divides, or at least make room for the socially aberrant and deviant, and so on, really trying to homogenize society in a very disingenuous sort of way. It is the collectivist impulse. And so we see it all over the place, but I would categorize it as theosophical. And that great unfinished work of Genesis chapter 11, Peter Bruegel's Portrait of the Tower of Babel, and the European Parliament building that was built in the fashion of Bruegel's Tower of Babel painting. It's that. It's the effort to finish the great unfinished work. And so you have a simple sort of mission statement in the work of the hierarchy that's published over at Lucius Trust that one can read to see evidence of what I'm talking about. And increasingly, there is a very, I think, obvious similarity between the work of the hierarchy, what is outlined, and the society that is emerging on the landscape that is coming into view. So returning to Hayek's Road to Serfdom, Chapter 10, Why the Worst Get on Top, thinking again with the election season in view, these words, I think, are very instructive. So backing up a little bit, Hayek writes, we must here for a moment return to the position which precedes the suppression of democratic institutions and the creation of a totalitarian regime. And I would say, you know, maybe we could think pre-COVID, or maybe for those who remember pre-9/11, there was something happening, and there was something happening before the COVID shenanigans, and this is a sort of rinse and repeat strategy. And again, as I mentioned in the first hour, if you can get people accustomed to emergency rule, my goodness, what a coup. You can do all kinds of things. You can do whatever you want, because during emergency, you do things that you wouldn't otherwise do. For example, if you're told that the building is on fire, if you're told the building is on fire, you might climb out of a window instead of going out through the front door. But, you know, if under ordinary, normal circumstances, you climb out the window to exit the building, somebody might want to have your head examined. In an emergency, though, who knows? And so we have come to a point where we have been sort of acclimated to this state of emergency rule. There are lessons historically I've read from Milton Mayer's They Thought They Were Free, for example, where the people were, the German people were acclimated to this emergency rule state, and that was part of the distancing of government, the separation of government from the people. And then government was just, you know, a term that became sort of disconnected from any real meaning. We've had warnings in our society, obviously, from our founding. Folks like James Madison in particular warned us about the problematic nature historically of emergency rule. We heard from the Rees Committee, for example, in the 50s, that indeed there was a conspiracy among the large foundations and their benefactors to change life in America radically, to alter it. If we can believe what Norman Dodd, the director of research for the Rees Committee, said in that 1982 interview with G. Edward Griffin, and I think we can, then based on Norman Dodd's conversation with Horace Rowan Gaither, the new president of the Ford Foundation, they were working, those folks were working to merge the United States and Soviet Union. And that impetus has not abated to this day, I would say. But in conjunction with that initiative, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, so-called, Norman Dodd said that they sent Catherine Casey, who was kind of a plant in the committee, to look into the minutes of the Carnegie Endowment. And it was an overwhelming task, but she discovered immediately upon its founding that in their own minutes they were at the Carnegie Endowment trying to devise a means by which they could radically alter life in America, and they settled upon the idea of perpetual war in a state of emergency. And then we fast forward to Senate Report 93-549 regarding the termination of the national emergency. In 1973, the Senate investigated the perpetual state of national emergency and how to end it. And discovered that because of this ongoing state of emergency that we've had since at least the days of FDR, and actually probably since the days of Lincoln, they said, the lives of Americans can be controlled through the executive in a host of ways. And instead of abolishing the national emergency in its various forms, they, you know, in that day, according to their research, they leaned on the Air Force, which was the only institution with the computing power, the capacity to do the kind of research that they wanted to research the laws on the books that had been written as a result of a state of emergency. And they identified thousands of laws, but they reduced that list, I believe, to about 400 and change, if memory serves. And they offered that list as evidence of the problem. And rather than abolishing and terminating the national emergency in its various forms, that very report that was written to as a justification and evidence for the termination of the national emergency, that became the evidence that was seized upon after September 11, 2001, immediately, the week after. It was CRS report 98-505, I believe, national emergency, that mentioned Senate report 93-549 as a justification. Hey, we have these 400 and something laws on the books that we can use, and, you know, America has been largely governed by a state of national emergency, perpetual emergency, for all this time anyway, so here's what we can do. That's problematic, but when you get used to that, when you become acclimated to that, as though that is the normal rather than the de jure rather than the de facto state of things, that is very problematic. And that's what we're looking at here. That's what we're increasingly sort of leaning into with each episode from September 11, 2001 to now the COVID. You can see with the COVID stuff, these guys are testing to see what's going to give the desired response in Skinner box feedback loop sort of fashion, in cybernetic feedback sort of fashion. Which thing is, you know, going to cause the reaction to allow us to implement the desired outcome? It's goal setting. We have this goal. How can we stir people up, get them excited so that they'll go, please, please do this thing as fast as possible. Don't listen to those crazy people who don't want to rush off and do something dangerous like what we've seen with the vaccines. And that's horrifying. With speaking of the vaccines, now we have evidence, proof, that the vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, are not just dangerous. Based on the research of Peter McCullough, Harvey Risch, and others, now looking at the autopsy data, and it's limited. They identified 325 cases. If their findings were a total of 240 deaths were independently adjudicated as directly due to or significantly contributed to by COVID-19 vaccination. In other words, in the autopsies that they could find, the vaccine was overwhelmingly cause of death, based on autopsy data, independently adjudicated. So now there's proof that the vaccines are the leading cause of death in those autopsy cases that they looked at. This is what happens when we get excited and rush off and do things in a state of emergency. But back to Hayek's Road to Serfdom. When you're in a state of emergency, back to what Hayek writes, in this stage, it is the general demand for quick and determined government action that is the dominating element in the situation. Dissatisfaction with the slow and cumbersome course of democratic procedure, which makes action for action's sake the goal. And I think we can just sort of pause here and think about the folks who said all the crazy things they heard. They repeated those things that they heard through the media, for example, that, you know, we need quick and determined action, as Hayek puts it. Action for action's sake is the goal. We got to do something. We have to do something. Well, whenever I hear that, I always think it's probably not advisable to rush out into a minefield, not knowing where the landmines are exactly. It's a minefield, but not exactly sure where all of the mines are. Might not be a good idea. Might be unwise and imprudent. And I think we can see, based on what we saw during COVID and even after, that it's a short trip to what Hayek outlines. So continuing. Well, just to put that all in one thought. In this stage, it is the general demand for quick and determined government action that is the dominating element in the situation. Dissatisfaction with the slow and cumbersome course of democratic procedure, which makes action for action's sake the goal. It is then the man or the party who seems strong and resolute enough to get things done who exercises the greatest appeal. Strong in this sense means not merely a numerical majority, it is the ineffectiveness of parliamentary majorities with which people are dissatisfied. What they will seek is somebody with such solid support as to inspire confidence that he may carry out whatever he wants. It is here that the new type of party organized on military lines comes in. This would be, we think, you know, maybe it's just me, but, you know, I think Trump was scary. I think Biden is scary for different reasons. But this is where a Gavin Newsom presidency, I think, becomes a very real prospect. And David Crowley's gray state, as a result, becomes a very real prospect also. In the central European countries, the socialist parties had familiarized the masses with political organizations of a semi-military character designed to absorb as much as possible of the private life of the members. All that was wanted to give one group overwhelming power was to carry the same principle somewhat further, to seek strength not in the assured votes of huge numbers at occasional elections, but in the absolute and unreserved support of a smaller but more thoroughly organized body. Think about all of the groups that have been vying for power in Nietzschean sort of fashion, that have been there's been an orchestration of coalescing these groups, you know, whether it's the immigrant population or other groups in recent years. Stick around, we'll finish that thought when we come back.
The secret to aging like fine wine is in the vines. Syrah grape seeds and skins contain high levels of flavonoids and resveratrol. Fermentation breaks these organic compounds down into smaller molecules, penetrating these therapeutic ingredients deeper into the skin, delivering faster and more effective results. Our handmade fermented skincare products are formulated with all natural ingredients and do not contain any phthalates or parabens. Similar products can cost as much as $180. At Natural Earth Medicine, we source our ingredients from local Arizona vineyards and cold process our oils to ensure that our customers receive the highest quality product in its purest form. Learn more at our website and try our fermented skincare products today. Visit naturalearthmedicine.com. That's naturalearthmedicine.com.
Consider this. Dead people see only what they want to see. And frankly, most of us are still dead. Let me give you the lessons of gold and five easy lessons. Number one, don't buy it because you need to make money. You buy gold because you need to protect the money you already have. Don't ever look at the price as a barrier. Look at it as an incentive. Number three, don't buy its paper pretenders. We talked about that a lot. Buy gold. Buy the real thing in the form of coins and bullion. Fourth, don't fall prey to glitzy television or Facebook ads. Do your due diligence instead. And that's what I try to provide you with and have for 26 and a half years on the air and 30 years in this profession. Fifth, don't allow naysayers to divert your interest. Allow yourself the right to protect your interests as you see fit. Jeff Bennett here. One of the ways you can do that is to contact Kettle Moraine Limited. Contact me by calling or texting me at 602-799-8214. 602-799-8214. You can also email me at kettlemoraineltd@cox.net. Let me help you protect your wealth and your family today. Once again, call or text us at 602-799-8214 or visit our website, SierraMadrePreciousMetals.com. Be glad to help you out. Be glad to answer your questions. That's what we're here for. No pressure, just good, hard, common sense. The decision then becomes up to you.
Welcome back. So, continuing from High X Road to Serfdom, Chapter 10, Why the Worst Get on Top. In the Central European countries, the socialist parties had familiarized the masses with political organizations of a semi-military character, designed to absorb as much as possible of the private life of the members. It's interesting to note in America that the sociologists and psychologists have told us that organized sports, for example, are kind of are like a gateway to military training. They're like a pre-military training. The more you can get youth into these regimented groups, the more likely they are to be amenable to a militarized form of life. And I think it's ironic I don't know about you, but as I drive around and look at playgrounds and ball fields and things that have been made, I remember playing sandlot baseball as a young boy, 8, 9, 10 years old. We used to go play in a field. Literally, it was a field. And I had one experience in particular. There were a bunch of us who played. You know, we would go to each other's houses, round up a bunch of people, and go and play in this field. And there was one game in particular we were playing. I hit a home run, and a kid that I was good friends with, and we played baseball together throughout the years, played at each other's houses. I hit a home run, and as I slid into home plate, this kid tagged me. It was a tie. Tie goes to the runner. He swore I was out. I swore I was safe. We were arguing over it as little kids. And so I said, you know, I was safe. He says, you were out. Safe, out, safe, out. Finally, he picked up my bat and hit me in the face with it, and I was out. And the next thing I knew, I was awakened by his dad with a cold compress on my face. Those were the fun times of, you know, growing up doing things like that, you know, in I don't know, being kids, basically. And so we played organized ball, league ball, but we also played on our own. We didn't really need practice the way that practice is done these days, because we were always practicing anyway. We were playing on our own. Every chance we got, we'd go out and ride bikes and probably ride over to the field and play. And that was customary. In contrast to that, these days, well, first of all, you know, back in those days, 8 or 9 or 10, I mean, if you're 8, that's probably too young. 9, maybe still too young. 10 was about right. These days, young kids are playing tackle football at 4 and 5 years old in some cases. Maybe touch and things, but there's still contact. They're playing contact sports at 4 or 5 years old. And people are wondering why these little kids are having problems with things like concussions. But I think as concerning as that is, the aspect of organized sports is as concerning. I think there is the growing mindset that in young people that there is no play or no sport outside the organization. And as I drive around from town to town, I don't see young people out. These days, it's summertime. Where are all the young people? We used to get forced to go outside. When I was a kid, moms would, you know, there were moms at home often with young people. And I remember getting pushed out at whosoever house we were at. You know, moms would say, go outside and play. What are we supposed to do? We're bored. I don't care what you do. You can't stay inside. Go outside. We were outside from morning till night doing whatever, riding bikes and doing all kinds of things, getting in trouble sometimes, doing crazy things. Hey, here's a set of golf clubs in the garage. Look at that. There are some golf balls. Let's hit them over the neighbor's house. That'll be fun. Crazy things like that we shouldn't do. But, you know, we learned lessons. Don't see kids out doing stuff like that anymore. Where are they all? They've been semi-militarized, as Hayek puts it. And that militarization has absorbed as much of their private life as possible. Stick around, we'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Do you or someone you know suffer from chest pain, blood pressure, cholesterol, or irregular heartbeat? Are you looking for a more natural solution to overcome these health challenges? You hear the ads all the time. If this stuff's so good, why doesn't my doctor prescribe it? That's easy. Doctors are not trained in natural medicine. Extendivite Heart Tonic does want you to be as healthy as you can be, and it really works. Take Extendivite for 6 months and your doctor will say, I don't know what you're doing, but don't stop. It's working for you. Get the dependability of Extendivite. Just see how you feel in 6 months. A 2 month supply of either capsules or liquid is only $69.95 plus shipping and handling. Call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Are you one of the millions of people who feel like there is a dark cloud hanging over their heads whenever they're using pharmaceutical drugs? For some, the short-term relief can turn into an opioid addiction nightmare. Have you ever wondered why CBD oil is a billion-dollar industry? It's because it works better than opioids and is actually healthy for you. However, CBD oil is stripped of all other helpful compounds found in the hemp plant. According to neuroscientists, the whole hemp plant, otherwise known as hemp paste, is even more effective than the chemically processed CBD oil. Are you ready to take back your health? You can try hemp paste for the price of a cup of coffee.
Hemppaste.com/RBN. Free shipping on orders over $50. See the banners for hemp paste at republicbroadcasting.org and visit hemppaste.com/RBN.
Find your inner rebel at Dixie Republic, the world's largest Confederate store, located in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. The anti-white, anti-Christ, anti-Southern world ends at the asphalt. Welcome to God's country. Log on to DixieRepublic.com to view our Southern merchandise, from flags to t-shirts to artwork. At the store, browse through our extensive collection of belt buckles and have a custom-made leather belt handcrafted in our Johnny Reb's Gun and Leather Shop. That's DixieRepublic.com, where you can meet all of your Southern needs.
Support those that support the network. Support Dixie Republic at DixieRepublic.com. Email proudsouthern123@gmail.com and let them know that RBN sent you.
Reluctantly crouched at the starting line, engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty except for one man, still driving and striving as fast as he can. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up. And long ago somebody left with the cup. But he's driving and striving and hugging the turns and thinking of someone for whom he still burns.
He's going the distance. He's going for speed. She's all alone. All alone in a time of need. Because he's racing and pacing and plotting the course. He's fighting and biting and riding on his horse. He's going the distance.
Welcome back. Bottom of the second hour of today's Road Warrior Radio broadcast, this Thursday, July 20th, 2023. Let's get to the heart of the matter here real quick. And then we'll go to the phones. So the semi-military character designed to absorb as much as possible of the life of the private life, as much of as possible of the private life of the members. You know, by the way, the sports includes girls' sports. volleyball, gymnastics, dance, this, that. All of this organized sport is kind of a militarized life primer. Continuing from Hayek's Road to Serfdom, Chapter 10, Why the Worst Get on Top. All that was wanted to give one group overwhelming power was to carry the same principle somewhat further, to seek strength not in the assured votes of huge numbers at occasional elections, but in the absolute and unreserved support of a smaller but more thoroughly organized body. And again, this normalizes that sort of militarized mindset. The chance of imposing a totalitarian regime on a whole people depends on the leader's first collecting round him a group which is prepared voluntarily to submit to the totalitarian discipline which they are to impose by force upon the rest. What do you do in the military? You follow orders. What was the Nuremberg defense? We were following orders. The basis of the Milgram experiment. Does this actually work? Although the socialist parties had the strength to get anything if they had cared to use force, they were reluctant to do so. They had, without knowing it, set themselves a task which only the ruthless, ready to disregard the barriers of accepted morals, can execute. Again, Gavin Newsom presidency. That socialism can be put into practice only by methods which most socialists disapprove of is, of course, a lesson learned by many social reformers in the past. The old socialist parties were inhibited by their democratic ideals. They did not possess the ruthlessness required for the performance of their chosen task. It is characteristic that both in Germany and in Italy, the success of fascism was preceded by the refusal of the socialist parties to take over the responsibilities of government. They were unwilling wholeheartedly to employ the methods to which they had pointed the way. They still hoped for the miracle of a majority's agreeing on a particular plan for the organization of the whole of society. Others had already learned the lesson that in a planned society, the question can no longer be on what do a majority of people agree, but what the largest single group is whose members agree sufficiently to make unified direction of all affairs possible. Or, if no such group large enough to enforce its views exists, how can it be created, and who will succeed in creating it? And here we arrive finally at the three main reasons. There are three main reasons why such a numerous and strong group with fairly homogeneous views is not likely to be formed by the best, but rather by the worst elements of any society. And of course, since it's formed by the worst elements, the worst identify with the worst sort of characters. You know, birds of a feather sort of thing. There are three main reasons why such a numerous and strong group with fairly homogeneous views is not likely to be formed by the best, but rather by the worst elements of any society. By our standards, the principles on which such a group would be selected will be almost entirely negative. So what are they? And I would argue this is the essence of communitarianism, by the way. By our standards, the principles on which such a group would be selected would be almost entirely negative. In the first instance, it is probably true that, in general, the higher the education and intelligence of individuals become, the more their views and tastes are differentiated, you know, in nuanced fashion, but still, and the less likely they are to agree on a particular hierarchy of values. It is a corollary of this that if we wish to find a degree of uniformity and similarity of outlook, we have to descend to the regions of lower moral and intellectual standards, where the more primitive and common instincts and tastes prevail. And again, not to diverge, but, you know, to digress for a moment, we start thinking about this, and, you know, some people will say, well, that's, you know, it's the same thing with Christianity. Perhaps, but again, the operative question is the meta distinction. Who's in charge? Who decides? Because if you're really a Christian, you're reading the Bible, you're praying, you're inviting the Holy Spirit in. The next thing is the article I mentioned recently, Why Jesus Needed the Holy Spirit. And so that is the question. Who's in charge? Who decides? And for the Christian, it has to be the God of Exodus 20. And, you know, in this case, obviously there's a vacuum. Who's in charge? Who's deciding? Who decides what the standard of the day is? So continuing, it is a corollary of this that if we wish to find a high degree of uniformity and similarity of outlook, we descend to the regions of lower moral and intellectual standards where the more primitive and common instincts and tastes prevail. This does not mean that the majority of people have low moral standards. It merely means that the largest group of people whose values are very similar are the people with low standards. It is, as it were, the lowest common denominator, which unites the largest number of people. And I would argue a corollary to this is the folks who have been conditioned to have a form of a thing but lack the substance. Like I've said recently, again, we're Americans, but who can recite any of the Declaration of Independence, Constitution, Bill of Rights? We are, you know, America was founded as a Christian nation, we argue, but who could recite any of the Ten Commandments? A form without the substance. If a numerous group is needed, strong enough to impose their views and on the values of life on all the rest, it will never be those with highly differentiated and developed tastes. And, you know, I think by the very nature of those who do those things, generally speaking, they respect, they have a regard for others in that sense that I mentioned in the first hour from Hayek's Road to Serfdom, Chapter 1, The Abandoned Road. You have a natural respect or at least regard for that in others, allowing them to differentiate their own and develop their own tastes. It would be those who form the mass, quote unquote, in the derogatory sense of the term, the least original and independent, who will be able to put the weight of their numbers behind their particular ideals. This is where we bump into the cliche attributed to Mencken, the pathetic belief in the collective wisdom of individual ignorance. If, however, a political dictator had to rely entirely on those whose uncomplicated and primitive instincts happen to be very similar, their number would scarcely give sufficient weight to their endeavors. He will have to increase their numbers by converting more to the same simple creed. Here comes in the second negative principle of selection. He will be able to obtain the support of all the docile and gullible who have no strong convictions of their own, but are prepared to accept a ready-made system of values if it is only drummed into their ears sufficiently loudly and frequently. It will be those whose vague and imperfectly formed ideas are easily swayed and whose passions and emotions are readily aroused, who will thus swell the ranks of the totalitarian party. And so again, here I would say those in America who have a form of a thing but lack the substance thereof, how many of those do we see? And how dangerous are they, a society pregnant with these folks who can be persuaded, influenced, perhaps even coerced in some cases, to adopt a ready-made system of values if it is only drummed into their ears sufficiently loudly and frequently? It is in connection with the deliberate effort of the skillful demagogue And there is no more skillful demagogue than someone like a Gavin Newsom, I would say. To weld together a closely coherent and homogenous body of supporters that the third and perhaps most important negative element of selection enters. It seems to be almost a law of human nature that it is easier for people to agree on a negative program, on the hatred of an enemy, on the envy of those better off, than on any positive task. The contrast between the we and the they, the common fight against those outside the group, you know, otherizing, which is the precursor to eliminationism, seems to be an essential ingredient in any creed which will solidly knit together a group for common action. It is consequently always employed by those who seek not merely support of a policy, but the unreserved allegiance of huge masses. From their point of view, it has the great advantage of leaving them greater freedom of action than almost any positive program. The enemy, whether he be internal, like the Jew or the kulak, or external, seems to be an indispensable requisite in the armory of a totalitarian leader. So here are the three main reasons Hayek lists. And I would argue these are all at work in America today. That the we have a lowest common denominator sort of impetus at work. There's an effort to encourage this. Indeed, there has been an education for several decades now, several generations actually. We've talked about it. It's been discussed widely on this network for, you know, since the beginning. And again, back to the Reese Committee, in their conclusion that there was a bloodless constitutional revolution that occurred in the 20th century in America, and that it could not have happened without preparing education in advance to endorse it, in the words of the Reese Committee and their findings. And, you know, part of the preparation of education was to produce in young people precisely the kind of mindset that Fitta had in mind, and that Bertrand Russell mentioned in The Impact of Science on Society. And that is a terrifying prospect. So that's probably enough for now. Those three main reasons are really what I wanted to focus on. And hopefully we can all sort of ruminate on those three main reasons. The lowest common denominator, those who have no strong convictions of their own, but are prepared to accept a ready-made system of values if it's only drummed into their ears sufficiently loudly and frequently. Again, I argue in America that we have folks who have a form of a thing. What does it mean to be American? They have a form of a thing, but they deny, they lack the substance thereof. And then the ability of the skillful demagogue to weld together a closely coherent and homogeneous body of supporters along the agreement on a negative program, the hatred of an enemy, the otherizing of others. And this has been exploited, weaponized and exploited many times, obviously. Machiavelli wrote about it, for example, and the Club of Rome mentioned it in the First Global Revolution. Man will be his own worst enemy. In trying to save the planet, we should just, you know what, if we could just get rid of people, that would be such a great thing. Anyway, hopefully that makes sense. Enough about that for now. To the phones, James in Vancouver, thanks for calling. Welcome.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
You find that leaders are usually predators. Hayek talks about how the bad people get to the top. It's the predators that end up doing the jobs.
And, yeah. Speaking of that, I think it's interesting that, you know, through the COVID stuff in particular, we heard about the fascination with bats, and we know that Bill Gates has a fascination with mosquitoes, vampiric things that suck blood.
Yeah. So there's certain people in society who are anointed to be the so-called, Kurzweil, Thiel, Musk, Gates. This is the conglomerate of those who are anointed to be somehow telling us what we're supposed to be doing. And I was going to say that I make a rule, and I've lived with it for, I think, at least 20 years, is I never listen to AM radio, FM radio, and seldom watch television at all. In fact, I don't have a TV that works. So in that sense, I'm served quite well by being disjoint from society as a whole. And back to you, your comments.
Well, you can't be part of the homogenous herd if you don't get your daily dose of propaganda and input on the talking points of the day.
Yeah. I think maybe go ahead.
I think that's a wonderfully liberating state of mind, personally.
Yeah. Hayek tends to be, I read him when I was in law school. He was in some of our law books, and he emphasized the individual, being an individualist rather than a socialist. He's not a socialist at all. And I would argue neither was Nietzsche, but I just wanted to talk about predators being leaders. I think this is a very serious issue.
Absolutely. I think the point that I've made about those that predatory class attacking their own constituents, I think that point applies with force, you know, which induces Stockholm syndrome. And of course, those people who get attacked are going to say they're going to defend their kidnapper. Everybody wants to save face. Nobody wants to admit they voted for the predator.
Yeah. Another thing, if I could mention, and I think it is important, is I've been looking at this meeting between the Pope and Zelensky that happened in May. May is, I think, the month of Mary. And Zelensky presented a icon to the Pope. Did you see it? It has Madonna on it, but the Christ child's been blotted out, silhouetted in black.
No, I didn't see that.
I wondered if you'd have a comment. Yeah, well, I think this is really a sinister type of abomination. And I think it has some kind of significance that's very, very dark. Just wanted to mention that to you. If you could have a look at it. And I'm trying to analyze what could have been said at the meeting. For example, the Curia, the cardinals, there were cardinals from the Curia there. Zelensky shows up at the Swiss Guard doors with the Swiss Guard there in a suit. And then he decides he's going to put on his black T-shirt with this insignia on it. And he looks, I'd say, quite demonic and just quite disgusting. Well, the Pope doesn't look too much better, but this is a very broad statement to me as who's in charge of the war in Ukraine. You know, was the Pope saying, or the Curia saying to Zelensky, well, we have to have peace, or was the Curia saying, no, you're not fighting hard enough, you see? So I think this is something to look at for the future. Back to you.
Or is it all is going according to plan? Yeah, that sweatshirt insignia is.
Right, right. That's exactly what it could be. But the idea of the Christ child being blacked out.
Yeah.
This is, I think this is something that should be looked at. And
I'll take a look at that.
If you would. And we could get back together and possibly kind of get some ideas on what you see in that meeting. There's a whole bunch of pictures on the internet.
I think
posted, so.
The meeting reminds me of, you know, all of the supervillain kind of stuff, whether it's Mission Impossible more and more it seems life is imitating, you know, predictive art in predictive fashion.
Well,
and since we've been groomed on all of that stuff for decades now, it just seems normal to the generation that came up on that stuff. So, you know, the Mission Impossible or the Marvel, DC comic stuff, or what's the other thing I'm thinking of? It reminds me of that, you know, arch supervillains meeting openly, discussing things together.
I think if that kind of icon were presented to a pope 50, 60 years ago, I mean, that would have been, it never would have happened. And now they seem to be celebrating some kind of avant-garde style. And well, when you have what the styles are, transgender and no gender and a thousand genders, and then this icon. And I think there's something very, like I say, dark and sinister. But have a look, and then we can talk again.
I will. That's an interesting. While you're talking
about
it,
it's saying there's no Christ. Christ never existed. This is the implication one can get right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And I know I tend to be a Gnostic, maybe, and so on and so forth. But I think it's worth discussing. This is a serious precedent to me in the church after 2,000 years. Anyway, James says,
I'm perhaps traditionally a Gnostic, but this is too far even for me.
Right. Well, you know, I'm saying that, I am, you're getting me to admit, yes, I'm a Christian, okay. But
in Hayek. In Hayek's sort of fashion, if they'll, you know, to borrow in, you know, the cliche of Pastor Martin Niemöller, basically, if they're going to do it here, then who's safe? So,
right.
Do it with the Pope.
I heard your baseball story. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Getting knocked out. Yeah.
We're at the end. Folks, I hope it was informative. As always, it's truly an honor and a pleasure. Take care. God bless. We'll catch you on the other side.
Blackout, because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.